Let's get into a little bit about the Ba'ath Party, or the Ba'ath Party. It has been written and said both ways, B-A apostrophe A-T-H and B-A apostrophe T-H, Ba'ath and Ba'ath. For the simplification of us Westerners, I'll just stick with Ba'ath Party in this video. Now, this video won't be about the current events of Syria and the Ba'ath Party today, but more so the creation, the formation of it, and then the transitions it went through and its ideology and the transitions its ideology went through throughout the years. So we can get an understanding of the root of the Ba'athist Party and the Ba'athist ideology. And for this video, we'll be diving into the book The Ba'ath Party and the Creation of Modern Syria by David Roberts. And he was a member of the British Embassy. And his credentials of being in Syria from the 60s all the way to the 80s, underneath different positions. He was head of the Chancery in Damascus from 1963 to 1966. Then he was the ambassador in Damascus from 1973 to 1976. Then he was the ambassador in Beirut from 1981 to 1983. So many of the people he talks about in this book, he personally knew. So let's start with the creation of the Ba'athist Party and the ideology. We go to David Roberts, The Ba'ath and the Creation of Modern Syria now. The intellectual climate in which a young Arab grew up in the 1920s and 30s, as did the founders of the Ba'ath, was complicated, but an underlying feature was Arab nationalism. Because remember, they were underneath French imperialism at the time. A theory which directly influenced the Ba'athist leaders in the 1930s and 1940s, as it influenced and had continued to influence the Levant in general, namely the Greater Syria theory of Antoun Sahadeh. In 1936, Sahadeh wrote The Birth of Nations while he was imprisoned by the French for his subversion. His work was in circulation before Ba'athism was formulated. In the early 30s, Sahadeh started the party, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, also known as the PPS as well, the Parti Populaire Syrien, or the SSNP, Syrian Socialist Nationalist Party. The foundation of the PPS also preceded that of the Ba'athist, or even its discussion groups. The points of similarity are too numerous to either be coincidental or unimportant. Both parties had a formal secular ideology and both had a structural organization. Hegel's view of the state influenced both parties. Both favored industrialization as a panacea for agricultural backwardness and strove to abolish feudalism. Both took the same oblique view of Islam, praising it as the motor of the Arab world while holding back well short of any endorsement of the Shahida or the Sharias. And basically, just to dumb down the Hegelian view of the state is essentially just the expression of the will and ethics of the people. As he says in the philosophy, the state is the actuality of the ethical idea. It is ethical mind qua the substantial will manifest and revealed to itself, knowing and thinking itself, accomplishing what it knows and in so far as it knows. The state exists immediately in custom, immediately in individual self-consciousness, knowledge, and activity, while self-consciousness in virtue of its sentiment towards the state finds in the state as its essence and the end product of its activity, its substantive freedom. The state is absolutely rational inasmuch as it is the actuality of the substantial will which it possesses in the particular self-consciousness once that consciousness has been raised to the consciousness of its universality. This substantial unity is an absolute unmoved end in itself in which freedom comes into its supreme right. On the other hand, this final end has supreme right against the individual, whose supreme duty is to be a member of the state. So essentially, the state is a representation of the will, and at the same time, while this is the true, in Hegel's mindset, the essence of freedom with the will creating the state apparatus, at the same time, the individual is subjected to what we could call the common good, which was the manifestation of the state through the ethics, through everything that composes of a people and their outwardly expressions. So Hadde's doctrine was that man was the product of evolution and of his social environment, the physical environment in which he and his ancestors had lived formed him. The second element was a human community, a race or group of races which that environment had molded. So Hadde then defined a nation as follows. The nation is the sum of human communities which lives a unified life in their interests, in their destiny, in their spiritual and material factors, rooted in a determined region of the earth, from which it obtains through the inter-influence between the community and its geographical ambiance during the course of its evolution, the particularities and characteristics which distinguish it from other human communities. Naboth parted company with the PPS and indeed banned it, once they got into power. So let's go into the founders of the Ba'ath Party itself. Obviously heavily influenced by Sadahe, the founders of the Ba'ath. Michel Aflaq was born in Damascus in 1905 of a Greek Orthodox family of grain merchants trading in the Haran. He certainly absorbed Marxist ideas at Sorbonne and later in Beirut. But the consensus of those who knew him is that he began fundamentally as an Arab nationalist. When he taught humanities at the Tahij in Damascus, Aflaq also fell under the influence of Kamal al-Ayed, a man of Germanic and Hegelian ideas. It is probably no coincidence that the first known political act of the embryonic Ba'ath was to support the pro-German coup of Rashid Ali in Iraq in 1941. Aflaq seems indeed to have founded the Ba'ath in 1940 as a small discussion group whose influence gradually spread. He was its main theoretician and is still its canonical authority in ideological manners. Salah al-Din Bitar, or Bitter, however you want to pronounce it, was a Damascenese, but his family apparently had North African origins. His career closely followed that of Aflaq, whom he knew well when both were being educated in Paris. He also taught at the Tahij School in Damascus, at the same time as Aflaq taught humanities. Zakai al-Arzui was an Alawite, and Alawites are just a different sect, or I don't know if they'd even claim themselves to be a different ethnicity of Arabs within Syria, but it specifically stems from their religious beliefs. So I don't even think they're a true genetic ethnic minority, but more so probably a religious sect. But anyways, he was an Alawite born in the 1900s in Alexandretta. He was a teacher in 1934, but was dismissed for opposing French policies. He was also the founder of the National Action League in the 1930s, opposing the mandate. So you can already see all three of the starting characters of the Ba'athist Party. They're already intellectuals, basically, but they're all kind of starting, going down their own road of Arab nationalism. And against the French occupation and the French imperialism, and kind of starting their own think tanks, their own little pseudo parties, I guess you could call them, until they eventually formed the Ba'athist Party. But you see this with a lot of with the creation of revolutionary parties, is usually they have humble beginnings. Usually it is people just looking for a different way, a new way forward, and it's individuals starting their own direction and eventually meeting up with each other at some intersection of ideology. Personalities affect history, even the history of ideologies. Both Aflaq and Bitar were intellectuals with a strong leaning towards theory. With hindsight, it is not so unfair to suppose that much of the subsequent history of the Ba'ath is explained by the failure of these two intellectuals to control the military. And we'll get into this later. Aflaq more or less admitted as much in 1963. The Ba'athists issued its first communique in July 1943. And they go on to say, "We represent the spirit of Arabism against materialistic communism. We represent living Arab history against the dead reaction and contrived progressivism. We represent complete Arab nationalism, expressing the product of the personality against empty nationalism, which does not go beyond lip service and which ethics refute. We represent the gospel of Arabism against professional politics. We represent the new Arab generation." Finally, in 1945, Syria would officially be able to separate from their French occupiers and form an independent state. When the Ba'athist was launched in the 1940s, it attracted minorities in the provinces. A reforming, if not yet full-blooded socialist, ideology had an automatic appeal to the downtrodden peasantry. A secular ideology, which is pretty revolutionary for an Arab community. A secular ideology, it had to cross swords with the hated Sunni, the landowners of the countryside and the merchants of the town, the officers in the army and the folk who undoubtedly governed Syria. The Alawites were natural allies of the Ba'ath from the beginning. The Arab Ba'ath in 1945 was still an incipient movement which only possessed a narrow base of students and educated people, and had a limited spread among liberal professions and officials, and its main activity was concentrated in Damascus. So it's like most of these parties, and which should give hope to even people today, a part of a small party. All of these revolutionaries' parties start off as a small group of people talking about ways to go about changing the current processes. So don't lose heart, because every mighty oak tree first starts off as a seed. 1947 was a year of political ferment. The Ba'ath was formally set up as a political party. The founding conference of the Ba'ath was held for 3 days in the cafe of Rashid al-Safiri in Damascus. About 200 delegates attended from Syria. Despite their limited numbers, they represented different parts of the country. A number of Lebanese and Jordanian intellectuals and students at Damascus University also attended. The meeting on the Constitution elected Michel Aflaq and appointed an executive committee of 3 members, Bitar, Wahib, and Saeed, a Sunni Ba'athist recruit from Deir al-Zor. So they hold their first great conference, and not only Syrians, but people from other places attend this, and Aflaq, one of the creator, essentially, you know, one of the higher placed founders of the three, gets named their first, you know, appointed executive leader. As far as international relations go, as they started, they said higher Arab interests govern relations with the superpowers' blocs, and support for United Nations friendship is important with all states except Britain, France, Spain, Turkey, Iran, and the United States. So at first they had hostilities toward these specific countries for their own specific reasons. The Arab policy was the communique calls on the Arab states to encourage a popular direction in a review of agreements and concessions to the foreign states and companies. Their internal policy, it denounces bourgeoisie policies and calls for a reform of electoral law, the Ba'ath to raise the social and cultural level of the people. Husani al-Zaim, who had been appointed the chief of staff of the army, took over the government of Syria on 30th March 1949. Zaim clearly distrusted all political parties, including the Ba'ath, some of whom's members, including Aflaq himself, he arrested. So another interesting fact about Syrian history is after the French lost their imperialistic powers over Syria, Syria went through a series of coup d'etats, coups, revolts, seizures of power by generals or whoever else. So until the Ba'athists came in power, there was a steady flow of discontent, revolution, and people being ousted from government and new governments taking over. So it was chaos. Syria as a country, as a culture, as a people, did not have the chance until the Ba'athist Party took control to grow as a nation and as a people, because they were always restarting. There was always so much conflict. So this is one of the instances, and now they threw in prison some of the leading Ba'athist Party member people, and Aflaq, the leader, being one of them. So back to the book. Aflaq secured their release by a letter to Zaim announcing his resignation from the political committee of the party and begging for clemency. This was an action he would never be allowed to forget. When you have purely intellectuals and not intellectual warriors or warrior philosophers or any type of man of action of that character, you have this. He essentially bitched out. He essentially begged to be released and said, "We wouldn't cause you no problems. Please let us go." Now, while that did get his release and the release of some other people, it besmirched his honor. And like was mentioned, it was something that would always be brought up against him, and rightfully so. Now, when this main sect of the Ba'athist Party, they would go on to lose control of the Ba'athist Party, and the Neo-Ba'athists who rule today through Assad would eventually take over. And this is because they were more men of action. And this is also a trend we see throughout history. The intellectual is essentially impotent in the process and advancement of revolutionary politics. We go on, like I was saying, there was constant coup d'etats. This character named Muhammad Sami al-Hinawani, a well-known Syrian officer trained by the Ottoman Turks, deposed of Zaim on the 14th of August of 1949, murdering him in the process. So here comes another military person in charge now. The Ba'athists collaborated with him, and Aflaq served as Minister of Education in the government of all parties in which Hinawani immediately formed with Hashim al-Atassi as both President of the Republic. So Zaim lets out Aflaq, who says, "Hey, I promise we won't do anything against you." And of course, he helps, you know, he supports the next people that come around and have a coup against the government. Which is also another lesson we can learn from history. Showing mercy to your opponents is highly overrated. And Zaim would pay the same price many have when they've shown mercy to people's weakness. Especially when we look at character. A person who would beg for his release from captivity, denounce his political views, and swear submission is obviously either a coward or a person lacking of character, which is the last type of person you should show mercy to. Because whatever promise they make to you, they obviously have no honor, so they have no true loyalty. From the Ba'athist point of view, the most important event was the election of 15 November 1949. The Ba'athists fared disastrously. Bitar and Aflaq both failed in Damascus. Only Saeed succeeded, albeit a weak organization in Deir al-Zor, which was thereafter to be the Ba'athist stronghold. There was also an internal dispute between Bitar and Saeed on the one side and Aflaq on the other. This may well have had its roots in Aflaq's well-known dislike of political conflict and his preference for theorizing. But it also focused on the party's failure in the election and Aflaq's famous letter to Zaim. See, he's not able to live down this cowardly letter he wrote to Zaim begging for his freedom. So of course people are going to bring that up against him anytime they had any kind of disagreement with him. All this formed the background of the Second Congress of the Ba'ath, which took place at the end of 1949. So we have this tiny group that hasn't gained, you know, much notoriety yet, and has had some struggles. And now, even amongst this tiny group, they're split and they're fighting amongst each other. Which, again, you see this happen throughout history through a lot of revolutionary parties as they're growing. And it's comforting in a sense where you see all these trials and tribulations. And Nasser in Egypt was kind of going through the same thing too. And even around the same time, that it's kind of encouraging to see that so many people have gone through so many dysfunctional periods and still overcame to be successful one way or another. It is now time to introduce the lost member of the Ba'ath, Akram Hurani. Hurani had a strong military bent. He took part in the guerrilla attack against the French in 1944, in alliance with Shishak Ali at one time. In January 1950, he founded his own Arab Socialist Party. When the official history, and the official history is like the Ba'athist documentation of their history, which I would have liked to do this video off of the official history, but A, it's hard to find an English copy, and B, it is a bit propagandistic in the sense that it portrays things sometimes more positively than probably should be through the unbiased eye. But anyways, the official history cites Hurani's official establishment of a party as one of the factors of the Ba'athist. The Ba'athists had to consider after its poor performance in the elections. This smacks once more of rationalization after the event. But on this occasion, it is no doubt correct. Hurani's main political platform was the liberation of the peasants from the oppression of the feudal landlords, especially in the Hama area. And then, of course, another coup happened in 1949, the same year the other coup just happened. Once again, this was the chaos that was going on in Syria. And this is why you can fast forward it today and say this is why it's insane to try to oust the Ba'athist party from power, because you'll just get this same repetition of coup d'etats and coups going on over and over again of people vying for power. So barely were the elections over when on 19 December 1949, a coup largely organized by Colonel Adib Shashkaliki, an army commander, yet again, in cooperation with Hurani, deposed Hinuwai and set up a civilian government under not very remote military control. From the Ba'athist point of view, there was three vital developments in this period. First, there was a split between the Ba'athist secular ideology and Sunni orthodoxy, which was to have consequences which continue to this day. And we're seeing that play out in Syria today. Secondly, the Ba'athists gained strength, both because of the merger with Hurani and because it thereby acquired a military connection, which it had been conspicuously lacking before. Thirdly, there was Nasser's ascension to power in Egypt. So all these three factors are going for the Ba'athist, at least in their eyes, are going for the Ba'athist party right now. Shishak Ali banned all political parties in Syria in April 1952 after student riots in Aleppo, which he put down ruthlessly. Aflak, Bitar, and Hurani were arrested. So eventually they were let go. And by December 1954, yet again, Shishak was overthrown by a military coup. There was a merger between Hurani's Arab Socialist Party and the Ba'ath. The only formal effect of this was to add the word socialist to the title of the Ba'athist Party and to add Hurani to the leadership of Aflak and Bitar. Elections were held in September of 1954, at which the Ba'athists gained 17 seats in a parliament of 142. Let's go into the Gamal Nasser period now. Nasser's coming to power was indeed of capital importance for the Ba'athist, but he was not to become an irresistible pan-Arab magnate until 1955 and afterward. If it had looked at him more closely, the Ba'athist might have thought Nasser rather too military for its taste at that stage of its evolution. He would also have appeared to be a little short on ideology, as Aflak was to observe a few years later in an article in a Beirut newspaper. At the time, however, he was a heaven-sent partner. whom the Ba'ath could hardly afford not to back. He was a successful revolutionary and exponent of Arab unity, whatever precisely he meant by that. He controlled the center of the Arab world and its largest military power. His movement belonged in general to the left, and even the Nazi leanings of some of his supporters must have been a bond rather than a barrier. It was simply now or never for the Ba'ath. On 9 December, Aflaq announced that the Ba'ath would propose a law of federal union with Egypt. There was clearly going to be a union, the only question unresolved being who was going to ride on the bandwagon. Even the communists, who had seen Nasser oppress their party in Egypt, dared not oppose it. While Nasser was a strong man appealing directly to the masses, the Ba'ath had no single outstanding leader, an elite party membership, and, on its own showing, little direct mass appeal. Aflaq indeed confided to a Beirut newspaper that he expected the Ba'ath to play a leading part in the Union because of its more sophisticated political philosophy. Meanwhile, the Ba'ath began to experience the realities of life in the Union. Important Ba'athists like Hurani and Bitar found themselves transferred to Cairo and thus cut off from their own power base and associates. The Union government imposed tariffs on certain imports into Syria without doing the same in Egypt. He, Nasser, would impose his central authority on Syria, and the Ba'ath, who had boasted that they had brought about the Union and were even its ideological mentors, would take the blame for all the regime's shortcomings. So at first they were bragging about how, you know, they helped this Union become, and then after Nasser starts flexing his power essentially over Syria, and a lot of Syrians are like, hey, we know what's going on here, kind of fell back on the Ba'athist party because, you know, while everything was looking good, they were bragging about it, but now it's all attributed to them when it's going bad. In accordance with the institutions of the Third Pan-Arab Congress in Beirut, the Ba'athist ministers resigned from the government of the UAR at the end of 1959. The Ba'athists had given up on the UAR as a vehicle for its political aspirations. And the UAR is the United Arab Republic, started by Nasser. It's essentially was intended to be like the UN of the Arab countries. So let's go to the Ba'athist actually getting some power now. We fast forward a little bit into the book. The collapse of the Union with Egypt and the coming of the separatist regime in Syria had profound effects on the membership and organization of the Ba'ath. There was also inevitably an influx of new blood into the party, and most of the newcomers must have been disillusioned with the old leadership. The Fifth Pan-Arab Congress of the Ba'ath met in Homs in May 1962, with Aflaq still as Secretary General. Its main tasks were to reconcile the various views on union and rebuild the organization of the party. The Congress set up a temporary regional command whose committees were to reorganize the Syrian party. Three resolutions set out the structure which would make the future union acceptable to the various factions. Regions were to have an authority in regional affairs. There was to be a federal government with a president and vice president in a full governmental apparatus. And coordination between regions was to come about gradually. Syria, Iraq, and Egypt signed the Tripartite Agreement on 17 April 1963. Under it, a federal government was to control foreign affairs, defense, economic planning, educational, and a number of other subjects. A further measure of the Ba'athist advance to power was setting up the Ba'athist paramilitary organization, the National Guard, on 30th of June. Although the truth is by now most unlikely to be discovered, the military committee was almost certainly the decisive factor in hastening a Ba'athist takeover and frustrating the admittedly not very promising agreement of 17 April. On 22 July, Nasser announced Egypt's withdrawal from the agreement of 17 April. He also denounced the Ba'athist for being against religion. The prospects of renewal for the union between Syria and Egypt were now dead. The regime was more military than Aflaq and Bitar would have wished, But those were the realities of power in Syria. The military committee purged or retired non-Ba'athists from the army and replaced them by relatives or friends. The original leadership, to put it mildly, looked less than perfect. A lot of younger men had joined the party, and some were in important positions. The Ba'athists had to elect a new regional command to replace the ones dissolved in 1958 under the Union. The new command contained three soldiers: Hafez al-Assad, Hamid Ubaid, and Rabah al-Tawil, plus five other civilians, including Din al-Atisa Shufi. Both these civilians were radical quasi-Marxist members of the party. Al-Shufi was elected secretary general. So Assad enters the picture here, or at least the Assad family does. The regional congress proceedings in September 1963 were overshadowed by the 6th Pan-Arab Congress 1 month later. But its three main effects seem to have been: 1. A clean sweep by the radicals in the election to the regional command. 2. The eclipse of Bitar, elected neither to the regional command nor to the Syrian delegation to the Pan-Arab Congress, despite his rank and service. 3. The military committee's advance to power in the party, although this was little more than a recognition of brute fact. So here come the men of action. Here come the military men, fueled by ideology, but also fueled by their means and ability to commit action. They were thought and action, while the creators of the Ba'athist Party were merely thought. Intellectuals that like to theorize and you know, have student discussion groups and pontificate on the best ways forward. Well, we see them struggle for about 20 years to gain power like that. And then we see the military men, younger men, action-orientated men, kind of ride in on the crest of the wave of the ideology of the Ba'athist Party and kind of seize it for their own. Now let's get into a little bit of the Ba'athist doctrine of what they originally believed. What we'll come to learn is the ideology becomes more pragmatic and changes more to the realities of present moments. But originally, the fundamental principles were explained in the First Congress. The First Congress of the party met in April 1947 in a cafe in Damascus and agreed on the constitution. From that moment, the Ba'athists became an official party. Fundamental principles. First, the Arab nation is one and free. Second, the Arab nation has a personality, from which follows freedom of speech. Third, the Arab nation has an internal mission, which is to destroy colonialism and extend the hand of friendship to humanity at large. General principles. It is a socialist and popular party whose socialism derives from Arab nationalism. It is revolutionary, since revolution is the only means to its declared ends. This entails a struggle to destroy colonialism, unite the Arabs, and overthrow the social and political system in the Arab world. An Arab is defined as one who speaks Arabic, who has lived on Arab soil, or one who, after having been assimilated to Arab life, has faith and belonging to the Arab nation. Notice there's nothing about Islam in there, which always has been a conflict between Ba'athist and Orthodox Sunnis and Shiites, is the fact they are secular. Internal policy. The articles prescribe a constitutional parliamentary regime. The judiciary is independent. Military service is compulsory. Foreign policy. This is a government by Arab nationalism. The Arabs will struggle to destroy colonialism, abrogate all treaties which degrade from Arab sovereignty, and respect the liberties of all people. Their economic policy? This is socialist. There is a limit to the ownership of land and industry, and real estate may only be owned within the confines of justice, but property and inheritance are permitted. The state will control internal and external trade. Their social policy? This will protect the family, marriage, public health, trade unions, and cultural activity. Social classes are to be abolished, as is anarchistic nomadicism. Education. This is to be Arabized and nationalized. The abortive Nasserist coup in July had left the Baathists at last in undisputed power. Aflaq drafted an ideological report for the 6th Pan-Arab Congress of the Baathists entitled Theoretical Starting Points, henceforth called simply the Muntalaqat. Apart from the Constitution, this is the only comprehensive ideological statement ever to have been formally endorsed by the party as a whole. All in all, then, the Muntalaqat, with the report of the 6th Pan-Arab Congress, is the main canonical source of Baathism on the evidence available and in the opinion of informed local observers and actors. The Muntalaqat consists of an introduction followed by three sections on unity, freedom, and socialism, the main slogan of the party. All right, so let's dive into some of their breakdowns on their slogan of unity, freedom, and socialism. And like he was stating in the book, that outside of the Constitution, which we went over some of the primary beliefs, the Munt is a collection of the main part of their original ideology. Once again, we'll get into the Neo-Baathist and when they took over, the ideology became a lot more pragmatic. And one can argue even more successful once it became more pragmatic. But anyways, let's get into it. So unity. The Baathists, from the outset, have always asserted that the idea of Arab unity should go hand in hand with the Arab people's struggle for freedom and that socialism could steer it. The party has tended in its struggle against colonialism, which has tried to divide the Arab nation, and communism, which has tried to promote a non-Arab loyalty, to make Arab nationalism an object in itself. Arab unity must sweep away regional barriers. The United Arab State must pursue an international policy of peaceful revolution against colonialism and multinational corporations and against Israel, their lackey and agent. The Arab economy must be integrated and developed. It must hold its own in a world of economic blocks. The movements must gradually liquidate the legacy of colonial divisions. Unity should be established by extending territory across frontiers. This is best done by democratic socialism at the level of the masses. As a result, organic unity will come about between vanguards. Now, this was a bit idealistic, and the Neo-Baathists completely disregarded that. Hence, there has to be unity of theoretical starting points, but on a democratic, not on a dogmatic basis. They cannot be imposed. It can also only be done by stages. And like I said, the Neo-Baathists, they completely threw that out the window, and it became more on a dogmatic basis than quote-unquote democratic base. Next, freedom. Freedom for the Baath means primarily political and economic liberation from colonial domination. Its fundamental humanism has always regarded freedom and social justice as indispensable and therefore has seen the destruction of the capitalist mode of production as indispensable. Local communists are subservient and bound by dogma, and the Soviet Union falls into error again and again. But positive neutrality, if anything, outweighs non-alignment. And the party favors the socialist camp over the capitalist world. There are two shortcomings in the party's performance as regards freedom. They are in the domains of military and parliament. Until the Iraqi Revolution of 8 February 1963, the party had failed to convert the army into a revolutionary instrument in the hands of the masses because it was not organically part of the party's structure. As a result, in the past, there has been coups, opportunism, and reaction. Likewise, the party fell into the errors of parliamentarianism in accepting bourgeoisie parliaments. It overlooked the revolutionary mission, which involves the overthrow of both bourgeoisie and the feudal system. Freedom must mean primarily liberation from colonialism abroad, including in its forefront the liberation of Palestine. In politics, freedom is not an abstract concept, but means that one class has certain social advantages over another. In particular, it is not the bourgeoisie notion of freedom in politics. Parliamentary democracy of the Western type is not a model for Arab society, since it is the apparatus of bourgeoisie power. Parliamentarianism in the Arab world has led to military coups and individual dictatorships, which have also failed. Popular revolutionary democracy is therefore required. Its object is to destroy reaction and the bourgeoisie feudalist framework of democracy, conversely liberating the energies of the people. This can only come about with revolutionary vanguards leading the popular masses. This means centralized democratic powers, which would entail direct free elections at all levels, from the village right through to the national level. The vanguard exercises authority in the name of the people through such representation. This is the collective leadership. To achieve this, the people must be organized in such frameworks as trade unions, peasants, unions, students, federations, youth organizations, officials and employees, associations, and women's organizations. In all this, the party is not ubiquitous, but only the vanguard, the motor. There must be a leading party, as the experience of socialist construction confirms, especially in developing countries. Its policies must be clearly set out for the masses. It must eschew personal ambition within the party and politically educate the masses. The party must therefore, 1. Avoid bureaucracy, the bane of socialist experiments. 2. Improve and dominate the administration. 3. Use the army and military service as an ideological instrument and merge the vanguards in the military sector. 4. Practice frankness with the masses. 5. Wipe out illiteracy. And 6. Emancipate women. And lastly, socialism. The last tenet, Arab socialism, the title which the party adopted for its doctrine in the course of its struggle against both communism and reaction, in particular, the acceptance of private ownership beyond personal usage, was a petty bourgeois notion and allowed bourgeois mentality to taint the party. The program has to be one of socialist transformation, since nothing less will permit the Arab world, which is largely feudal, backward, because it is basically agricultural, and suffers from an inefficient capitalist system, to advance and cope with the Second Industrial Revolution. In the course of this, the bourgeoisie must be overthrown. Socialist transformation will entail the following. 1. Popular ownership of main sectors of the economy. 2. Assimilation of the petty bourgeoisie into the socialist sector, when that is on a sound and established basis. 3. Nationalization, which may involve state capitalism at first stage, but which should involve popular participation so as to avoid bureaucracy and its attendant vices and lead on to a perfect socialist society. 4. Agrarian revolution rather than mere agrarian reform, i.e. collective farms. 5. Harnessing of savings and investment, with which goes planning right through to the level of a united Arab state. And 6. Mobilization of the energies of the masses to those ends, for which a revolutionary vanguard, the party, is indispensable. Essentially, we can reduce the Mundt to 4 basic propositions. 1. The party takes Arab nationalism as the basic donnes And Donnez is a French word meaning a set of assumptions of the political situation. The question to be asked is, what path should Arab nationalism take? Number two, Arab unity is the only safe and true path for Arab nationalism. But drawing on the Egyptian experience, it must be a unit based on common ideology rather than on geographical mergers. Three, freedom has to be revolutionary in character, since it depends primarily on the successful struggle for Arab unity against colonialism and imperialism. It excludes bourgeoisie notions of liberty and affection for parliamentary institutions. And four, it follows from the preceding points that socialism will be the goal of the Arabs, but it will be Arab socialism, i.e. a socialist ideology which takes into account the national characteristics of the Arabs. All right, let's go into the Neo-Ba'athists now and the rise of the Neo-Ba'athists, and this is what rules today. While there was always resentment and revolution fermenting with Sunni Muslim groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, in fact, the war within Syria today is nothing new, as since the seizure of power by the Ba'athist Party, there has always been Muslim fundamentalist and extremist groups that have tried to overthrow the government for a more theocratic system. Where the Ba'athist Party did not see revolution coming from was from their own ranks. The military branch of the Ba'athist Party would eventually pull off a coup and replace the old leaders and founders. As often happens, as I mentioned earlier, in history, the weak-bodied and weak-willed intellectual will lose out to men of action. And this was indeed the case for the Ba'athist Party. And the rise to power of the Neo-Ba'athists took place under this. Military men of action, more pragmatic, more looking forward to results than ideology, seized power and led the direction of the Ba'athist Party to what exists today. Now, Bitar flew to Beirut and later Paris. He took hardly any part in politics thereafter, but gave interviews and wrote a little. He was murdered in Paris in 1980. Aflaq fled to Beirut. In a speech, he belated and denounced the Neo-Ba'athist for having ruthlessly perverted the form and membership of the party. He continued to live in Beirut for some time and was regarded as the Secretary General of the Pan-Arab Command by the Iraqi Ba'athist. Now, the Iraqi and Syrian Ba'athist Party did not get along. In fact, the Syrians backed the Iranians against the Iraqi Ba'athists. So they definitely had a split, and they were hardly ever intertwined with each other. In fact, why they both call themselves Ba'athist, I'll never know. They are similar in a sense, but at the same time, for numerous reasons, at each other's throats. The Neo-Ba'athists were more from the Marxist and socialist camps than the conservative and rightist side of the Ba'athists. So, only a month after the coup, the Soviet Union announced that they would finance the Euphrates Dam, also now providing money and even positive press in regards to Syrian Ba'athists, while the Iraqi Ba'athists remained to be viewed as more reactionary right-winged. Now, even among the Neo-Ba'athists, there was a split. Some factions, namely Assad, had thought, and this is Bashir Assad's father we're talking about here, had thought that some in the party were becoming too subservient to Moscow. Also, Assad felt it more important to unify with the Iraqi Ba'athists and to have a united front against Israel. But the current government, led by Jadid, felt that the socialist transformation in the homeland was a more pressing issue. So eventually, yet another coup would take place with Assad forces against Jadid forces. We return to the book. Assad had already established the military force needed to control the events in Damascus. In a bloodless action, his troops surrounded all necessary offices and arrested the opposition. Hafiz al-Assad took over as prime minister. So this starts the Assad reign, and we see his son ruling today. Now, whether it was wise to go into a monarchical type system like North Korea did? I don't know. I tend not to think so. But that is essentially what happened. But once Bashir's father, Daddy Assad, took over, during the first decade of the Ba'athist Party, the number of students enrolled in school nearly doubled. So you're already seeing the education. And we see this with a lot of nationalistic governments, is the level of education rises. Because when the goal becomes the nation and the nation are the people, you want the people at the highest quality you can get them, therefore making the nation at the highest quality it can be. Unlike liberal capitalism, modern day capitalism, where you put your citizens into debt for daring to seek an education. How dare they? How dare they? And then on top of that, you know, you're brainwashed by leftist professors on top of that. Or you're given the SJW teachings of public schools that go on today. On top of your debt. But in nationalistic, pseudo-fascistic or proto-fascistic ideologies, you have the encouragement of education. Because you want to encourage the individual to reach his full potential so he can contribute to the nation, therefore to his people, therefore to his combined society, as much as possible at his highest quality, therefore making the nation of its highest quality. So let's get into the economy. The Ba'athist record in running the economy was mixed. It undoubtedly eliminated some of the corruption and speculation, especially in food and essential supplies, which had been rife during the Second World War and immediately afterwards. It stabilized the cost of certain basic commodities. On the other hand, many banks, large companies, merchants, and import landowners were severely hit by nationalization, and some of them disappeared. To my understanding, this has changed a bit, and it's not as nationalized as it used to be in the current day. The major achievement of the Ba'athists was land reform. The Ba'athists extended the land reform which had begun under the union with Egypt. This is an important point in view of the large part played in Syrian life by peasants and agriculture, where more than half the entire workforce is employed. The regime had, in fact, distributed about 1.5 million hectares, involving about 55,000 families as beneficiaries. There was also a development of peasants' organizations. Even if the party undertook this largely in order to strengthen itself, it undoubtedly conferred some corporate strength on the peasants as well. Land reforms, provided they can be financially and technically sustained, are usually the most durable of all social and economic measures. In economic and commercial affairs, Assad was careful to assure private enterprise that there would be a scope of business and that private property would be respected. This is this fascistic third position principle here. Now that the main programs of nationalization and agrarian reform were settled. So once they felt they got things under control, they were able to open up the market a bit. And he ends with this: in ideological terms, it is hard to locate Assad's corrective movement at all precisely, if only because the Neo-Ba'athist has left no defined doctrine with which one might compare it. So after the Neo-Ba'athist, specifically Assad, took power, the doctrine essentially became pragmatism. But pragmatism guided by the idea of Syria first. This method has been continued on today with his son Bashir al-Assad, which is highlighted even before he took office, as they had to change the constitution to allow someone under 40 to become president. Much like his father, Bashir al-Assad, main opposition stems from battling off Muslim fundamentalists. But unlike his father, the Muslim extremist Bashir Assad faces have American and international backing, who all desire Assad, thus the Ba'athist Party's downfall, which would only return Syria to be doomed once again to be a nation plagued with continual coup d'etats and coups and revolutions and resentment amongst the many different minorities of ethnicities and religions and regional areas and even social classes that exist within Syria today. So, to wrap it all up, what David Robert presents in his book, The Baathists and the Creation of Modern Syria, is that at first the Baathist Party started with a well-defined ideological platform, but unable to gain true traction in society. Eventually, the Neo-Baathists came into power and were surrounded by more men of action, being military-minded men, more influenced by pragmatism than idealism. And to this certain extent, despite the certain monarchical existence of Bashar al-Assad taking power, which leaves us to question, will his son take power after him? Have taken the more pragmatist angle, but never with the intent of the self first, but of Syria first. And I think even the most biased Baathist Assad-hating person would have to admit that Syria, under the Baathist Party, has become a lot more powerful, beneficial to the people of Syria than anything that existed post-colonialism or during French colonialism, which I had hoped would highlight why it is a horrible mistake to go into Syria and seek to replace Assad, thus the Baathist Party, just like it was a horrible mistake to go into Iraq and replace Hussein, thus the Baathist Party, just like it was a horrible mistake to go into Afghanistan and to fight with the Taliban, just like it was a horrible mistake to go into Lebanon and kill Gaddafi. One can only hope America does not make the same mistake again. But as things look today, unfortunately, it looks like we desire, foam at the mouth, to make the same mistake again and destroy the Baathist Party, the only steady thing in Syria since its emancipation from European colonialism. Suggested readings for this topic are The Baathist and the Creation of Modern Syria by David Roberts.